You're listening to Feedback with Bill Saunders on News Talk 830 WEEU and 830WEEU.com. A new generation of talk.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Feedback, your on-air town square here on the Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders along with Sean Tansky. And our phone number is here is 610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459. And our dedicated text line, if you prefer to text us your opinion or your comments, whatever the case might be, that number is 484-650-3373. And Sean, we've got a couple of social media websites we're on, right? Whoops, wait a minute. I got to pot you up here. There you go.
Can you hear me?
You could have done all the talking in the world and nobody would have heard a word you said.
Yeah, no, I've definitely done that before. yes, we are on Twitter, formerly Twitter, known as X now, at Feedback WEEU, and Facebook at Feedback WEEU as well.
And podcasts. They can hear us in podcast form, too,
yep,
right?
That's right. You could listen to us on wherever podcasts are available, the big three, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Podcasts. Also, you could also listen to us on our website, 830WEEU.com. You go there. Up top, you'll see different tabs. If you hit podcast, click on that. You'll see feedback. You'll see Mornings with Mike. You'll see Jack's Backyard. You'll see our roots in Reading. And you'll see our high school sports catalog there. And say we have a big interview and you just want to listen to the interview, you do the same thing. Go to 830WEEU.com. You click on the tabs there. You'll see programs. You click on that. You click on feedback. Scroll down, you'll see a couple interviews that we've done here.
Wow, a lot going on there on the internet, huh?
Yep, that is that's right.
And what was this you were telling us yesterday about rating these podcasts?
Yeah, so if you listen to our podcast on, say, Apple Podcasts, there's a rating system there. If you rate us 5 stars, you'll like the podcast, and you leave a review. If we get enough of those, Apple Podcasts is going to start pushing our show to people who may not have you ever even heard of the show, but they like a similar style show. So a news
When you say
program.
Pushing, you mean they would recommend
feedback
to other people?
Yeah, so they
people?
Will get a thing. It would be like, hey, we think you'll like this, and they'll give you a couple shows. And if we get enough five-star reviews, enough comments, enough reviews, we could start showing up there for people with similar likes who just may not know that feedback exists.
Oh,
it's pretty cool. So it's a way to help us here, you and me, and it's a way to help get feedback to a broader audience.
Cool. Like that. Thank you, buddy. Appreciate the information today. All right, let's take a look at today's top three topics. A new study shows how much money is needed today to live comfortably in one's retirement years. We'll share with you what that number is. Here's a hint. It's reached an all-time high. And taxpayers are taxpayer subsidies really making wind and solar power cheaper and better for Americans? And do voters care that President Biden is spending $1 trillion to fight climate change? Well, we'll find out. And at 11 o'clock this morning, Reading City Council President Donna Reed joins me to discuss council business, and she'll be taking your questions. That's during the 11 o'clock hour, as Donna Reed, the president of Reading City Council, joins me. I'm looking forward to having her back with us again today. All right, let's get started with that story about how much it would take you to live comfortably in your retirement years today. I got this from Fox Business, and they're reporting on a new study that's out. It's a study that was published by Northwestern Mutual, and they found that the magic number that Americans believe they need in order to retire comfortably, are you ready for this? Hit $1.46 million this year. That's the highest level on record. The figure represents a nearly 15% jump from the $1.27 million that Americans said they needed last year, easily outstripping the current 3% inflation rate that's going on now in this country. Over the past 5 years, Americans' quote-unquote magic number has surged 53% from the $951,000 reported back in 2020, the year I retired. Well, actually, I retired in 2019. What am I talking about? That's according to a financial services firm. So we've gone from, in a mere four-year period, we went from $951,000, believed to be the magic number to comfortably to retire, to now $1.46 million. By generation, both Gen Z and millennials anticipate they will need more than $1.6 million to retire comfortably. Any particular number on your mind, Sean, as to, I know that you're probably not even thinking retirement right now, given how young you are, but any magic number that you're thinking of that you would need in order to retire comfortably when you do?
No, I mean, I mean, yeah, hey, it would be nice if I was a millionaire. I could say that.
Yeah, right. Or yeah, or win the lottery. Yeah. Yeah.
No, because I don't even know. I haven't really talked to any of my relatives that are retired, because I don't talk money with a lot of people. But like, I wouldn't even know where to begin to like. Like, I know you should start saving now, but, like...
Right, yeah.
I don't know. It's just different, because I know my parents are thinking about it, but I don't know necessarily what their plans have been.
Well, you're not alone. I mean, it's far into the future for you, so it's not something you have to worry about now. But you should start saving for it, even if you're not worrying about it now.
Yeah.
Because retirement will be here before you know it. Take it from somebody who remembers being 23 and thinking, that was only yesterday.
Yeah, no.
how I wish it was only yesterday. But those years go by fast, and before you know it, you're thinking, oh, my goodness, why didn't I save more when I was younger?
Yeah, no, it definitely feels like it's starting to fly by. I mean, how are we already in April of 2024? This year has flown by so far.
Yeah, it has.
I can't believe it's actually April. It's like we're almost halfway done with the year. Like,
where did 2023 go?
Yeah, 2023 went by real fast.
It did.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, by generation, both Gen Z and millennials anticipate they'll need more than $1.6 million to retire comfortably. Among high net worth individuals are those with more than $1 million in investable assets. The figure catapults to about $4 million. Even though they expect to need more money in retirement, Americans are not actually saving more, according to this Fox Business article. The average amount that U.S. adults have tucked away for retirement fell to $88,400 from $89,300 last year. That's a far cry from this $1.46 million figure that they're saying is needed to retire. However, that is down more than $10,000 from the five-year peak of $98,800 set back in 2021, that according to this study. In total, the gap between what people think they need for retirement and what they have actually saved is $1.37 million. By comparison, just 5 years ago, that was about $874,000. Either way you look at it, we're talking about huge numbers here. But you think $874,000 is a huge number. Boy, in retirement, you could go through that just like that.
Yeah, no, it's also crazy to think, like, you need $1 million to be comfortably retired, or in that case, getting by on retirement.
Right, like, yeah.
I can't even imagine, like, $100,000 in my bank account. To imagine that you need 10 times that, like, what?
Anyway, according to the study, across all segments, there are large gaps between what people think they'll need to retire and what they've saved to date. The study comes as Americans continue to confront stubbornly high inflation that has rapidly eroded their purchasing power and, in some cases, forced them to use their retirement savings as a financial lifeline. And Mr. Biden wonders why he's not getting credit for the economy. A separate study by the Alliance Life Insurance Company of North America shows that nearly 7 in 10 respondents say they have not contributed as much to their savings due to higher prices for everyday goods. while 42% of households reported dipping into their retirement savings. That's not good. Inflation has created severe financial pressures for most U.S. households, which are forced to pay more for everyday necessities like food and rent. The burden is disproportionately borne by low-income Americans, whose already stretched paychecks are heavily impacted by price fluctuations. While inflation has fallen considerably from a peak of 9.1% notched during June of 2022, it remains above the Federal Reserve's 2% target. But get a load of this. Here's a figure you've not heard Mr. Biden use. When compared with January 2021, shortly before the inflation crisis began, prices are up a stunning 18.49%. Yeah, that's how much prices have risen since Biden took office in January of 2021. So, yeah, even though he likes to use the current inflation figure to say everything is hunky-dory now, no, it's not. We're a far cry from that. And maybe that is the answer for the president, who is whining that people aren't giving him so much credit for the way the economy is today. Speaking of the economy, remember yesterday we were talking about Pete Buttigieg and how he says, oh, it's safe for me to walk my dog in the streets of Washington, D.C. today, as he's surrounded by a plethora of security guards, given his job in the federal government. Yeah, I'd be secure, too, if I had guys armed with submachine guns walking with me in the streets of Washington, D.C. Oh, my. Anyway, here's an update on that. Or at least to some extent, it's an update on that. This is from the Washington Times. As the seat of the federal government, Washington has long been regarded as being shielded from most economic turbulence. But businesses inside the district expect to be worse off financially in 6 months than companies in the D.C. region and the nation, according to a new survey that's out. The nonpartisan D.C. Policy Center sent surveys to 91 city businesses back in January. Among them, 73% predicted the D.C. economy would worsen, 13% said it would hardly change, and 14% said it would be somewhat stronger. Meanwhile, about 60% expected the D.C. region's economy to deteriorate, 20% anticipated no change, and another 20% predicted it would be somewhat stronger. In addition, 29% of those surveyed expected the national economy to be somewhat or much weaker. 33% predicted minimal or no change, and 37% said it would be somewhat or much stronger. Businesses no longer consider D.C. a safe haven, protected from inflation by the federal government, so says Yassim Sayan, who is executive director of the D.C. Policy Center, who went on to say this is a big change because in the past, the district has always outperformed the nation's economy, and now we're seeing it lag. According to the Small Business Administration, Washington had 79,814 small businesses last year, accounting for 98.2% of all companies in the city. The D.C. Policy Center said local businesses that were at least 10 years old employed more than 100 people and had more than $5 million in operating revenue in the last 12 months, accounting for a substantial portion of the survey sample. Their pessimism could reflect the city's weak commercial real estate market, since real estate, rental, and leasing companies had a strong representation among survey participants. That according to the think tank that did this survey. The survey also found that 4 in 10 district businesses expect gross revenues to be somewhat or much lower in the next 6 months, even though most say they were not letting employees go. It pointed to data showing that Washington's economy has declined as the rest of the nation recovers from the pandemic. As of November, 22% of all available office spaces in the D.C. Central Business District were not being used, according to the property management company Castle Systems. The Policy Center expects that that percentage to grow as former commuters keep working virtually from Maryland and Virginia over the next few years, prompting more businesses to end their commercial leases. According to Ms. Sayan, nearly 800,000 people worked in Washington before the pandemic, with two-thirds of them commuting daily from Maryland and Virginia. That included roughly 200,000 government workers and 570,000 private sector workers. She said private sector office occupancy is now about 50% on the best day. The federal government, nobody knows who is working from the office, Ms. Sayin added. Isn't that nice? Since the pandemic, people are just not coming into the office as often. Furthermore, a lot of people have moved from high-cost metro areas like D.C. to smaller, lower-cost Sunbelt cities like Atlanta. The survey comes as Washington grapples with an unprecedented funding crisis. City officials have blamed it on fewer people shopping, dining, or working downtown on weekdays since the outbreak of COVID-19. Other problems include pandemic relief funding drying up this year, crime-plagued retailers pulling out of depopulated streets. Do you hear that, Mr. Buttigieg? Yeah. Plunging commercial real estate values, mass transit ridership declining, and struggling restaurants closing. This is our nation's capital we're talking about here. The mayor down there, Muriel Bowser, has proposed deep cuts to social programs such as affordable housing grants and several tax increases, including a gradual sales tax hike to offset $800 million in budget deficits for fiscal year 2025, which begins October 1st. Yeah, that's the thing to do. When business is dropping so much, hike your sales tax. Cause more people to stop going there to shop. The D.C. Council must approve a new budget by June 12th. So there you have it. There's an add-on to that story of Mr. Buttigieg saying how safe Washington is today. I know it goes a little bit deeper than that, but still that is one factor that businesses down there in D.C. are feeling. All right, we'll take a break. We'll be back with more of this Wednesday edition of Feedback. You're on air, Town Square, in just a bit. Stay with us.
News you can use.
I feel more informed when I listen.
News Talk 830. WEEU.
And now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
Back to Feedback. You're on air, Town Square, here on the Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Our phone number is here, 610-374-8800. Toll free, 888-401-0459. And our dedicated text line is 484-650-3373. Well, there's an interesting column that appears in the New York Post written by Bjorn Lomborg. Mr. Lomborg is president of the Copenhagen Consensus, and he's a visiting fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's written a couple of books, including one titled False Alarm and another titled Best Things First. And his op-ed piece that appears in the New York Post today has the headline, Trillions in Taxpayer Subsidies Have Not Made Wind and Solar Power Cheaper or Better for Americans. So here's what Mr. Lomborg writes today. Despite us constantly being told that solar and wind are now the cheapest forms of electricity, governments around the world needed to spend $1.8 trillion on the green transition last year. Wind and solar are already significantly cheaper than coal and oil, is how President Biden conveniently justifies spending hundreds of billions of dollars on green subsidies. Indeed, arguing that wind and solar are the cheapest is a meme employed by green lobbyists, activists, and politicians around the world. Unfortunately, as the huge subsidies show, the claim is wildly deceptive. Wind and solar energy only produce power when the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. The rest of the time, their electricity is infinitely expensive and a backup system is needed. This is why global electricity remains almost two-thirds reliant on fossil fuels, and why we, on current trends, are an entire century away from eliminating fossil fuels from electricity generation. It's often reported that large emerging industrial powers like China, India, Indonesia, and Bangladesh are getting more power from solar and wind, but these countries get much more additional power from coal. Last year, China got more additional power from coal than it did from solar and wind. India got three times as much, while Bangladesh got 13 times more coal electricity than it did from green energy sources, and Indonesia an astonishing 90 times more. If solar and wind really were cheaper, why would these countries miss out? Because reliability matters. The typical way to measure the cost of solar simply ignores its unreliability. The same is true for wind energy. Biden's Energy Information Administration put solar at 3.6 cents per kilowatt hour, just ahead of natural gas at 3.8 cents. But if you reasonably include the cost of reliability, the real costs explode. One peer-reviewed study shows an increase of 11 to 42 times, making solar by far the most expensive source of electricity, followed by wind, which is why yesterday when we were talking about, I had a caller call in and share with us that she got notice that her electric rates are going up. That's why I said stay tuned. You ain't seen nothing yet. The enormous additional cost comes from the need for storage. Electricity is required even when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing. Yet our battery capacity is woefully inadequate right now. Research shows that every winter, when solar contributes very little, Germany has a wind drought of 5 days when wind turbines also deliver almost nothing. That suggests batteries will be needed for a minimum of 120 hours, although the actual need will be much longer since droughts sometimes last much longer and recur before storage can be filled. A new study looking at the United States shows that to achieve 100% solar or wind electricity with sufficient backup, the U.S. would need to be able to store almost 3 months' worth of annual electricity. It currently has 7 minutes of battery storage. Just to pay for the batteries would cost the U.S. five times its current GDP. And it would have to repurchase the batteries when they expire after just 15 years. Now keep in mind, here in Pennsylvania at least, thanks to the PUC, the utility companies are allowed to pass on the cost of their infrastructure improvements to you and me, the ratepayers. Globally, the cost just to have a sufficient batteries would run to 10 times the global GDP, with a new bill every 15 years. The second reason the claim is false is that it leaves out the cost of recycling spent wind turbine blades and exhausted solar panels. Already today, one small town in Texas is overflowing with thousands of enormous blades that cannot be recycled. In fact, we talked about that on this show a while ago, that we focused on that very town. In poor countries across Africa, solar panels and their batteries are already being dumped, leaking toxic chemicals into the soil and water supplies. Because of lifetimes lasting just a few decades and pressure from the climate lobby for an enormous ramp up in use, this will only get much worse. One study shows that this trash cost alone doubles the true cost of solar. If solar and wind really were cheaper, they would replace fossil fuels without the need for a grand push from politicians and the industry. If we want to fix climate change, we instead must invest a lot more in low carbon dioxide energy research and development. Only a significant boost in research and development can bring about the technological breakthroughs that are needed in reducing trash, in improving battery storage and efficiency, but also in other technologies like modular nuclear that will make low CO2 energy sources truly cheaper than fossil fuels. Until then, claims that fossil fuels are already outcompeted are just wishful thinking. That's Bjorn Lomberg writing in the New York Post. The op-ed piece has the headline, "Trillions in Taxpayer Subsidies Haven't Made Wind and Solar Power Cheaper or Better for Americans." Well, with all the money that Mr. Biden is spending to fight climate change, it's at $1 trillion right now. Do voters care about that? The Wall Street Journal asked that question in an article that appears in their paper today. And here's what they found. The president has done more to address climate change than any of his predecessors. That's true. So far, voters don't seem to care. The Biden campaign and a collection of progressive groups are trying to change that. They believe the president's record on climate change can boost his popularity with young voters. The strategy is risky because climate has never been a priority with voters, and it's unclear whether climate policies could reverse the deep skepticism many young people feel toward Mr. Biden. Recent Wall Street Journal polls have found that Biden's support among young people is shrinking compared with 2020, amid concerns about the president's age and his support for Israel's war against Hamas. Their first big challenge is to tell voters what Biden has accomplished. Paris Thompson, she's age 19 and she lives in Philadelphia. She told the Wall Street Journal Biden hasn't done enough on climate change. Here's what else she said. "Since he's been president, I don't think anything has changed." She's a Democrat, by the way. She says she's considering voting for independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in November. A journal poll, which surveyed voters in seven swing states back in March, found that just 3% of 18 to 34-year-old voters named climate change as their top issue. 3%. While most citing the economy, inflation, or immigration. That's roughly in line with voters of all ages, 2% of whom cited climate change as their top issue, and Mr. Biden is spending over $1 trillion on an issue that nobody cares about. Other polls show that young people are more likely than older voters to say addressing climate change is important, even if many don't name it as their top priority. Biden administration officials say climate is an economic issue. It certainly is, because the money he's spending on it is causing our economy to go down the tubes. My words, not what's in this article. They're pushing to get cash out the door to show the economic impact. Biden's campaign hopes to highlight the differences between Biden and Donald Trump, who dismisses worries about climate change. Trump has criticized subsidies for electric cars while promising to increase domestic production of oil and gas. U.S. fossil fuel output has risen to records under Biden, but many voters in states with lots of oil industry jobs feel Trump and other Republicans would be better for them. Biden's economic policies have been unpopular with a majority of voters, surveyed in recent journal polls. More than 60% of voters surveyed by the Yale University Program on Climate Change Communication said they have heard a little or nothing at all about the 2022 law known as the Inflation Reduction Act. And let me say it again, an act that had absolutely nothing to do with inflation and everything to do with climate change. That, by the way, that act contained about $1 trillion in tax credits, grants, and loans just for clean energy. The community and the population don't know about them, so it seems like nothing is being done, says Rebecca Pike, a 38-year-old undecided voter out there in Bay City, Michigan. Climate change is one of her top issues, but she hadn't heard about the climate law or other policies before talking to the journal. Climate change is disrupting Michigan's winters and threatening the state's farmers who grow everything from asparagus to cherries. A physical education and health teacher and nurse, Pike says she would welcome more investments in Bay City, like an SK Siltron CSS factory making semiconductor wafers for electric vehicles that opened a few years ago. The Energy Department recently said it would loan the facility $544 million to help fund an expansion and create 200 jobs in the city of about 30,000, where about one in four people live in poverty. Other recent loan commitments include $2.3 billion, with a B, for a lithium processor in Nevada, and $1.5 billion, with a B, for a nuclear power plant in Michigan. After hearing that the climate law is spurring similar investments across the country, Pike says she was more likely to vote for Biden. She's not alone. The Yale poll found that more than 70% of voters surveyed supported the Inflation Reduction Act after reading a brief description of it. But several young voters say in interviews they knew little about Biden's climate efforts. Some faulted the president for not doing more on the issue. Privately, senior officials expressed frustration that their efforts weren't resonating with the public. But, according to this Wall Street Journal article, they held out hope that voters will become more engaged on the issue as the election nears. A White House official said the following: "We need to show our work along the way because these investments do take time." Private groups are bolstering the campaign's message about climate change. Climate Power, a clean energy communications organization, is spending $80 million this year to promote Biden's climate actions. Much of the group's activity targets swing states and younger voters with digital campaigns. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is spending $200 million to help cities and towns access their share of the federal clean energy funding. A group called Invest in Our Future has about $240 million in funding commitments from organizations including Bill Gates's Breakthrough Energy and the Rockefeller Foundation for similar initiatives. The League of Conservation Voters Super PAC and affiliated groups plan to spend $120 million this election cycle, the largest investment in the group's history. All that money to try and educate people who, in essence, do they care? That's the question. Do they really care about the climate? Well, I throw that open to you and ask you what you think about the public's take on this. Is this an issue that resonates enough that that it will be an issue that will impact people's voting or not? Surveys are showing that's not the case, but I would like to get your take on it. 610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459. Because if it is the case, why are all these organizations spending millions of dollars to get the message out? All right, we'll be back with more feedback in just a bit.
Serving Collegeville, North Wales, King of Prussia, and all of Montgomery County, this is News Talk 830 WEEU.
And now back to feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back to feedback here on the voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU, where again the numbers are 610-374-8800. Or toll-free, 888-401-0459. We've been talking about climate change. Did you hear what happened there in Switzerland? If you haven't, let me share it with you. This from the Associated Press. Europe's highest human rights court ruled yesterday that countries must better protect their people from the consequences of climate change, siding with a group of older Swiss women against their government in a landmark ruling that could have implications across the continent. The European Court of Human Rights rejected two other similar cases on procedural grounds, a high-profile one brought by Portuguese young people and another by a French mayor that sought to force governments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But the Swiss case, nonetheless, sets a legal precedent in the Council of Europe's 48 member states against which future lawsuits will be judged. According to Karina Harry, an expert in climate change litigation at the University of Zurich. She says this is a turning point. Although activists have had success with lawsuits in domestic proceedings, this was the first time an international court ruled on climate change, and the first decision confirming that countries have an obligation to protect people from its effects, according to Harry. She says it would open the door to more legal challenges in the countries that are members of the Council of Europe, which includes the 27 EU nations, as well as many others from Britain to Turkey. The Swiss ruling softened the blow for those who lost on Tuesday. Here's what 19-year-old Sofia Oliveira, one of the Portuguese plaintiffs, had to say. The most important thing is that the court has said in the Swiss women's case that governments must cut their emissions more to protect human rights. She went on to say, their win is a win for us too, and a win for everyone. The court, which is unrelated to the European Union, ruled that Switzerland had failed to comply with its duties to combat climate change and meet emissions targets. That, the court said, was a violation of the women's rights, noting that the European Convention on Human Rights guarantees people effective protection by the state authorities from the serious adverse effects of climate change on their lives, health, well-being, and quality of life. A group called Senior Women for Climate Protection, whose average age is 74, had argued that they were particularly affected because older women are most vulnerable to the extreme heat that is becoming more frequent. A member of the group, named Anne Marr, is quoted in this AP article as saying, the court recognized our fundamental right to a healthy climate and to have our country do what it failed to do until now, that is to say, taking ambitious measures to protect our health and protect the future of all. Switzerland says it would study the decision to see what steps would be needed. Alan Chablis, who represented the country at last year's hearings, told the Associated Press, and I quote, we have to, in good faith, implement and execute the judgment. Well, the judge, who's also the court's president, stressed that it would be up to governments to decide how to approach climate change obligations, and experts noted that was a limit of the ruling. The European Court of Human Rights stopped short of ordering the Swiss government to take any specific action, underscoring that relief from the Swiss government necessarily depends on democratic decision-making to enact the laws necessary to impose such a remedy, so said Richard Lazarus, a professor at Harvard Law School who specializes in environmental and natural resources law. Activists have argued that many governments have not grasped the gravity of the climate change and are increasingly looking to the courts to force them to do more to ensure global warming is held to that 1.5 degrees Celsius mark. That would be above pre-industrial levels, in line with the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. A judge in Montana, and we talked about this one a while ago, a judge in Montana ruled last year that state agencies were violating the constitutional right to a clean environment by allowing fossil fuel development, a first-of-its-kind trial here in the United States that added to a small number of similar legal decisions around the world. Wow, just imagine the implications that this will have. Of course, as always is the case, the progressives are going to the courts to get answers that they can't get from their legislators. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? How much, and it's not just here in the United States, clearly, because they did that in Switzerland now, and the impact that that's going to have, and I'll bet not just on Europe, but also over here, as more and more people decide to take to the courts to get what they want. All right, do I have time here? I do not. All right, we'll talk about this in hour number two. I want to talk about the latest reaction to Mr. Biden's latest attempt at wiping away student loan debt. That and much more when the Wednesday edition of Feedback continues here on the Voice of Berks and Beyond.
Wait until I saw the sun. I don't know why I didn't come. I left you by the house of fun. I don't know why I didn't come. don't know why.
Serving Bethel, Hamburg, Birdsboro, and all of Berks County. This is News Talk 830 WEEU.
And now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and beyond.
I actually sat outside with a cup of coffee and just let the sun beat down on me, and I've got a little suntan today.
I'd probably just burn.
Yeah, I think I'm all ready for the pool season.
There you go.
No, a little wishful thinking there. Well, that wraps up hour number one of this edition of Feedback. And don't forget, we've got Reading City Council President Donna Reed joining us during the 11 o'clock hour today, and she'll be taking your questions. Then on Friday, Dr. Timothy Blessing, yeah, the rock star of Feedback, will be on with us at 9 o'clock this coming Friday. He's going to talk about third parties and, using his term now, the muddle they create in elections. And then during the 10 o'clock hour on Friday, State Senator Judy Schwenk will be here, and she too will be taking your questions. So that gives you some idea as to what's coming the rest of this week here on Feedback. But right now, it's time for news with Radio PA and ABC, and our own Bob McCool will have a check on sports for you. So keep it here on the voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU.
Now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and beyond.
Little ZZ Top to start off hour number two of Feedback on this Wednesday morning. You're on air Town Square on the voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders along with Sean Tansky. And our phone numbers here are 610-374-8800 or toll free 888-401-0459. Our dedicated text line is 484-650-3373. And oh yes, we've got an email address. It's feedback at 830weeu.com. Well, I got this from Fox Business as an update to Mr. Biden's latest attempt at wiping out student loan debt. Apparently, seven more states are now suing the president over that very policy. Here's what Fox Business is reporting. The Biden administration faces yet another lawsuit as a growing number of states seek to block his student loan handout plan, with Missouri and six other states filing a complaint yesterday. Missouri's Attorney General, Andrew Bailey, filed the lawsuit that argues that Biden's SAVE plan, announced back in February, is illegal and would cost American taxpayers $475 billion. That's billion with a B. Bailey's lawsuit comes just weeks after Kansas and 10 other states sued the Biden administration over the same plan. With a stroke of his pen, Joe Biden is attempting to saddle working Missourians with $500 billion in debt. The United States Constitution makes clear that the president lacks the authority to unilaterally cancel student loan debt for millions of Americans without express permission from Congress. Those are Bailey's words. The president does not get to thwart the Constitution when it suits his political agenda. I'm filing suit to halt his embarrassing attempt to buy the 2024 election in direct violation of the law. The Constitution will continue to mean something as long as I'm Attorney General, Mr. Bailey went on to write. Joining Bailey in the lawsuit are the Attorneys General of Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Ohio, Oklahoma, and North Carolina. Make that North Dakota, I'm sorry. Missouri and Arkansas both participated in the lawsuit that ultimately brought an end to Biden's previous student loan plan last year. And the Supreme Court decided 6-3 that Biden's plan was unconstitutional. But who cares what the Supreme Court has to say? Darn it, if he wants to give away free money to people to buy their votes, he's going to do it. President Biden has already lost on this question once, and he's refusing to follow the law. The Supreme Court could not have been clearer. President Biden cannot unilaterally cancel student debt and force taxpayers to bear the multi-billion dollar cost, so says Arkansas's AG Tim Griffin. Well, we'll stay on top of this and see where those lawsuits go. Wow, I saw this, and I couldn't believe it. An NPR editor is rebuking his own news outlet for their coverage of the Hunter Biden laptop story, the COVID lab leak story, and Russiagate. Are you ready to hear this now? This is from an NPR insider now. It's an NPR editor by the name of Yuri Berliner. He issued a lengthy rebuke of NPR's media coverage of major news stories over the last few years, such as the Hunter Biden laptop and the COVID lab leak theory, and called out the outlet's efforts to damage Trump's presidency. Wow. By the way, I'm getting this from Fox News' website. Berliner, a senior business editor at the outlet, wrote in an essay for the Free Press that NPR's coverage veered off the deep end when Trump was elected in 2016. He cited its coverage of Russiagate first and said NPR hitched our wagon to Representative Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, who peddled Trump-Russia collusion claims for years. He says Schiff, who was the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee at the time, became NPR's guiding hand, its ever-present muse. By my account, Mr. Berliner wrote, NPR hosts interviewed Schiff 25 times about Trump and Russia. During many of those conversations, Schiff alluded to purported evidence of collusion. The Schiff talking points became the drumbeat of NPR news reports, Berliner wrote. Again, this is from the Free Press now. After the Robert Mueller report found no credible evidence of collusion, he wrote, the Trump-Russia story disappeared from NPR's coverage. Berliner said the outlet pretended like it never happened. Berliner also pointed to NPR's decision to turn a blind eye to the Hunter Biden laptop story in 2020. The laptop was newsworthy, he writes, but the timeless journalistic instinct of following a hot story lead was being squelched. During a meeting with colleagues, Mr. Berliner wrote, I listened as one of NPR's best and most fair-minded journalists said it was good we weren't following the laptop story because it could help Trump, he wrote. He meaning Berliner. When the New York Post first reported on Hunter Biden's laptop in 2020, NPR infamously issued a statement as to why it wasn't covering the story. At the time, a popular narrative in liberal media was that the laptop was a possible Russian disinformation operation. Remember that? But its contents were later verified by multiple outlets that previously cast aspersions on it. NPR statement said the following at the time. We don't want to waste our time on stories that are not really stories. And we don't want to waste the listeners' and readers' time on stories that are just pure distractions. This from a news outlet that is taxpayer-funded, by the way. Berliner continued, but it wasn't a pure distraction or a product of Russian disinformation, as dozens of former and current intelligence officials suggested. The laptop did belong to Hunter Biden. Its contents revealed his connection to the corrupt world of multi-million dollar influence peddling and its possible implications for his father. Berliner also pointed to NPR's coverage of the COVID-19 lab leak theory, which he said the outlet was supposed to ignore. Similar to the Biden laptop story, the notion that the virus may have leaked from a Wuhan virology lab in China was dismissed as right-wing claptrap, before ultimately being accepted as at least a plausible theory in mainstream media. Over the course of the pandemic, a number of investigative journalists made compelling, if not conclusive, cases for the lab leak. But at NPR, we weren't about to swivel to even or even tiptoe away from the insistence with which we backed the natural origin story, Mr. Berliner wrote. Berliner said one of his colleagues on the science team was asked why they were so dismissive of the theory, and that his response was, quote-unquote, odd. The colleague compared it to the Bush administration's unfounded argument that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. Huh? Apparently meaning we won't get fooled again. But these two events were not even remotely related. Again, politics was blotting out the curiosity and independence that ought to have been driving our work, Mr. Berliner wrote of NPR. Reached for comment, an NPR spokesperson directed Fox News Digital to a memo to staff by Editor-in-Chief Edith Chapin, where she said she and her team strongly disagree with Berliner's assessment of the quality of NPR's journalism and integrity. We're proud to stand behind the exceptional work that our desks and shows do to cover a wide range of challenging stories. We believe that inclusion among our staff, with our sourcing, and in our overall coverage is critical to telling the nuanced stories of this country and our world, she wrote. Journalism is a collaborative process. Rigorous debate and self-examination are necessary parts of our pursuits of the facts. And exploring the diverse perspectives that drive world events is necessary to our public service mission. That's why we've built in processes to verify accuracy and why we adhere to the highest editorial standards. It's why we have a standards and practices editor, as well as a public editor to stand in for the audience. It's why we track sources so we can expand the diversity of perspectives in our reporting. We have these internal debates, enforce strong editorial standards, and engage in processes that measure our work precisely, because we recognize that nobody has the view from nowhere. With all this said, none of our work is above scrutiny or critique. We must have vigorous discussions in the newsroom about how we serve the public as a whole, fostering a culture of conversation that breaks down the silos that we sometimes end up retreating to. Ideally, she writes, we engage in this debate respectfully, with the goal of lifting up and strengthening each other's work, as our emerging strategic focus brings new insights into what audiences we do and do not currently serve, we have an obligation to more rigorously consider and measure how our coverage fulfills our public service to all audiences. Sounds nice, doesn't it? She concluded she was proud of the organization's work and lauded NPR as one of the most trusted news organizations in the country. And then she adds, let's not forget that the reason we remain one of the most trusted news organizations in the country is that we respect people's ability to form their own judgments. What are your thoughts on this? I'd love to hear from you, especially given the fact that NPR takes taxpayer dollars in order to function. Oh, and then we've got this update. You may have heard it on the news yesterday, but if you haven't, here it is. This from the AP. The first parents convicted in a U.S. mass school shooting were sentenced to at least 10 years in prison yesterday, as a Michigan judge lamented missed opportunities that could have prevented their teenage son from possessing a gun and killing four students back in 2021. These convictions are not about poor parenting, so said Oakland County Judge Cheryl Matthews, who went on to say, these convictions confirm repeated acts or lack of acts that could have halted an oncoming runaway train. The hearing in a crowded, tense courtroom was the climax of an extraordinary effort to make others besides the 15-year-old attacker criminally responsible for a school shooting. I'm clearly referring to Jennifer and James Crumbly. They did not know Ethan Crumbly had a handgun. He called it his beauty, and he had it in a backpack when he was dropped off at Oxford High School that horrible day in 2021. but prosecutors convinced jurors the parents still played a disastrous role in the violence. The Crumleys were accused of not securing the newly purchased gun at home and acting indifferently to signs of their son's deteriorating mental health, especially when confronted with a chilling classroom drawing earlier that same day. All right, so we got a lot to chew on there. Hope to hear from you, get your take on these issues. We'll be back with more feedback on this Wednesday morning in just a bit. Stay with us.
Serving Paoli, Glenmore, Coatesville, and all of Chester County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU.
Welcome back to Feedback. You're on Air Town Square here on the Voice of Berks and Beyond. 830 WEEU, where our phone numbers here are 610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459. I'll go to the phones in just a minute, but for those of you who didn't hear the ABC newscast at the top of the hour, inflation is still heading up. 3.5%. Yeah, forecasters were expecting it to be lower than that. Excluding volatile food and energy categories, so-called core prices rose 3.8% from a year earlier. Yeah, that's Bidenomics at work for you. And what did I see? The price of gasoline this morning coming into work, the gas station that just had the price of a gallon of regular gas at $3.59 yesterday is now $3.79 today. Yeah, the prices aren't going in the direction that Mr. Biden wants them to go in, clearly. Let's see if he taps the strategic oil reserve some more. Is there actually any oil left in there? He clearly can't fill it now. What did we hear the other day? They want to buy more oil to fill what he took out the last time around to make it look better. But now, because of the price of oil now, he's had to postpone doing that. Oh, my, oh, my. All right, I'll come off my soapbox now. Let's go to the phones. George in Lancaster wants to talk about that NPR story. George, good morning. Welcome to Feedback.
Good morning there, Captain Marvel. It's always a pleasure to hear you.
Same here. I'm glad you called in today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, sincerely. Gas station I go to in Oxford every Thursday has been slowly creeping up from 291 at the beginning of December. Then it was 323 last Thursday. Last night I saw it was 339.
Okay.
For same gas station. Now I don't know what's going on. It reminds me of a bumper sticker I saw back in the 90s. It said, "Don't blame me, I voted for Bush."
Yeah, yesterday when I filled the tank of my car, those stickers were back on the gas pumps with Biden pointing to the price saying, "I did that." I thought those had gone away, but apparently they're back again.
Yeah, go figure. Allow me to start my response to the NPR story stating this. My avocation and vocation, well, my avocation today is radio communications. I'm a ham radio operator, have been for 45 years. Worked in the industry as a radio engineer back in the early 80s. Traveled the country installing broadcast radio stations. Listening to radio communications, whether it be amateur or commercial, shortwave, commercial broadcast or shortwave broadcast, has always been something that I have enjoyed emphatically since, I'll say, the days when you were in high school, the late 60s, okay. Early to late 60s,
okay,
or mid to late 60s, rather.
I'm not that old. I didn't go to high school till 1970.
Okay, excuse me then for misplacing your age. Yeah, well, yet I still think we can qualify, both you and I, as what I politely call geriatric flagellators. It's a nice way to say something that's
Yes, we won't go any farther. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. July of 1977, I picked up my first two shortwave radio receivers. A 1957 Grundig Majestic console radio with a phonograph and a 1947 Stuart Warner Model 9001D, which copied 9 megahertz region of the shortwave spectrum. Once I started listening to those, to the shortwave broadcasts from other countries, whether it's Radio Moscow, at the time the BBC, the CBC, the Deutsche Welle, Vatican Radio, all over the world, I would hear a particular story or subject which was presented in various ways, which are very different than what I heard on American broadcast. Even though I looked at the Radio Moscow with a jaunted eye, for lack of another phrase, with suspicion is my point, I got to realize, you know, their point of view balanced out against the American news media that I hear gives me an opportunity to understand, how can I say, winnow. Do you know what I mean by winnowing?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Winnowing is separating the wheat from the chaff. I could get a better perspective of the situation. Now, I had to try to understand as a teenager, and would discuss it with history teachers, what's going on here? This is what I see. Well, you know, you got a good eye or good ear for it. I've always known NPR does not present the truth. Nor do I feel that other news media that I hear, no disrespect intended to you, Bill, I mean this with all my heart, you in particular present both sides of the story, which gives me a good opportunity to again, winnow. NPR has never told the truth as far as I'm concerned.
Well, let me stop you there. I wouldn't go that far to say that NPR doesn't report the truth. What I would say is they report a version of the truth, they believe it to be. Just like Fox News provides their view of what they think the truth is. And you're right. Your overall opinion is correct, that you really should get a well-rounded view of the news by going to different sources. In fact, Tim Blessing on this show said that he listens to the BBC as a source of information because of how different their version of what's going on in our country is from what our stations are reporting, or our newspapers are reporting.
Mr. Blessing is a first-rate gentleman. He's very well-rounded. I respect him because of his, neutral view, where he'll look at both sides. And I hold the same respect for you. It just seems to me that, okay, I take back my words if I could. I'd eat crow. NPR is not telling the whole truth. And that's when I have to take a look at the other side of the story. Again, listen to the BBC or Radio Moscow or somebody else in order to get, the winnow out the information. What bothered me about NPR is they didn't issue some sort of an apology, saying, hey, geez, you know, we weren't really necessarily right about this, pushing this point. As it turns out, the point that we were pushing was inaccurate. Regret pushing that point and not presenting the other side. But that's what you get from NPR.
Well, let me ask you this. Why should they apologize when they still believe that that their view of those particular stories is accurate?
That's a question I can't answer honestly. It seems, though, I suspect, they want to think their socks don't stink, and they don't want to have to eat crow. No matter what the actual whole story is, in Paul Harvey's words, are the rest of the story. They just don't want to face the entire story. They only want to present or perhaps even hyper-focus on a minority aspect of the story.
Yeah, I got to go here and real quickly, George, but any reporter, their story is going to be as good as the source they use. And if NBR relied heavily on Adam Schiff for their Russiagate story, then that explains why you didn't get the entire truth.
Let me conclude with this. Imagine the kaleidoscope and the circle of people. Pass that kaleidoscope around the circle of people, 10 people, looking at the very same light. Now, every one of us takes a snapshot of what's seen in that kaleidoscope. And each photograph is accurate in accordance to that individual's perspective. None of them are wrong, but they're not seeing the whole story.
All right, we'll have to end it. We've got to end it there, George. Got to go.
Thank you. Have a good day. I appreciate your time.
I appreciate your call. Thanks for calling in today.
You're welcome. Bye.
All right, bye-bye now. Let's go to Shillington. Matt wants to talk about, ruling by the Arizona Supreme Court.
Basically, Bill, in political science terms, you guys were discussing what's known as gatekeeper bias. I've done reports for the show on watching Fox News at 9 a.m. and CNN at 9 a.m. and then reporting what I saw. I always felt I was getting factual information on both, but the difference is which stories was the network emphasizing, which stories were they ignoring, and that's what is meant by gatekeepers. So, indeed, I did find that, and then what you do is you have to go to alternate sources, as George said, to get the whole story. Also, Bill, I'm confident I speak for a majority of the listeners when I say we enjoy you when you are on your soapbox. Okay? I think it adds a little spice to the show that is always good. And the only thing I keep reminding you, Bill, please try not to injure yourself when you're jumping on and off, okay?
I'll try.
Hey, my topic, Bill, yeah, I guarantee between now and November 5, political scientists will be pulling their hair out, trying to analyze and predict how the abortion issue will impact the election. Came across three developments on this front just in the last 2 weeks, Bill, and you probably came across them too, but I'll email you my sources. First, in Alabama, a state with one of the strictest abortion laws, a woman named Marilyn Lands, L-A-N-D-S, she won a state house race. She's a Democrat who campaigned on only two issues, in vitro fertilization and abortion. She won 62% of the vote, which, as you know, is landslide territory. But, Bill, here's what she said in her victory statement. Quote, "Today, Alabama women and families sent a clear message that will be heard in Montgomery and across the nation. Our legislature must repeal Obama's no-exceptions abortion ban, fully restore access to IVF, and protect the right to contraception. This special election is a harbinger of things to come. Republicans across the country have been put on notice. There are consequences to attacks on women's reproductive freedoms. From the bluest state to the reddest state, voters are choosing to fight for their fundamental freedoms." Again, Bill, that was in Alabama. Then just last week, the Florida Supreme Court issued two rulings almost simultaneously. First, Florida's new law banning abortions or restricting abortions, the court said it will be allowed to go into effect. But then the second ruling, almost simultaneously, Bill, the court will allow a ballot measure on reproductive rights to be placed on the Florida ballot in November. And so, therefore, that law, in effect, will be on the ballot because it will be a ballot measure. And I know this just hit yesterday, so maybe you didn't see it. But finally, by a vote of 4-2, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that an abortion law passed in 1864 will be allowed to take effect in 14 days. For people who recall American history, Bill, this law then was passed when Arizona was a territory and would not become a state for almost another 50 years. And, of course, women did not even have the right to vote until 1919. So the reaction to that Supreme Court decision, Bill, was immediate. First, they have now started gathering signatures. You knew this was coming. Signatures for a ballot measure to go on the ballot in Arizona in November to codify a woman's right to choose. They're gathering signatures. But again, Bill, throwing down the gauntlet, final point here. Speaking at a news conference after the court's decision, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays vowed, quote, "No woman or doctor will be prosecuted under this draconian law as long as I am Attorney General. Not by me, not by any county attorney serving in our state, not on my watch," end quote. And her office is looking for pursue options available to ensure the law is not implemented in the state. So, Bill, it's what, a little less than seven months away, but again, the gauntlet's being thrown down, Bill. We're seeing it in so many states. I took some poli-sci courses. I know you did too, but I don't want to predict how this is going to work, but it's going to be a wild card, my friend, okay?
Yeah, even Arizona's former governor, who is a Republican, was vehemently against the actions that were taken by the Supreme Court out there yesterday.
Very interesting. So that's all I wanted to do is just give an update, Bill. Thanks a lot.
All right, Matt, thanks for the call.
Yeah, goodbye.
Bye-bye now. We'll be back with more feedback on this Wednesday in just a bit. Stay with us.
Serving Myerstown, Fredericksburg, Newmanstown, and all of Lebanon County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU.
And now back to feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
Little Loggins and Messina there for you. Here on the voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU, as feedback continues. Let's go back to the phones right now and speak with Andrew in Ephrata. Andrew, good morning. Welcome to feedback.
Hey. Good morning, Bill. Thank you. I like your last caller. You mentioned about, you know, the court, you know, Arizona Supreme Court and everything like that. And he made some really good points. But I guess the point I want to make is, it was mentioned about the Alabama Supreme Court. About in vitro fertilization, and everybody was up in arms and couldn't believe it and all that. But my take is that, okay, when you have an embryo, I mean, it's a person. I mean, when the sperm meets the egg, that is a human being with constitutional rights. I mean, that's, you know, everybody's saying that, okay, it's, you know, they say discard the embryo. Like, what does that mean, discard the embryos, you know?
Whoops, did I lose you?
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, I mean, the embryo, everybody was saying, you know, they should, you know, be able to do this in vitro fertilization and discard, you know, quote unquote, discard the extra embryo. What does that mean, discard the embryos?
Well, that means that the embryos that that are still in storage that were not used, after a certain time, and I'm not an expert on in vitro fertilization, but after time, they end up discarding what has not been used, what sperm has not been used, or what fertilized egg has not been used, I should say.
So they're basically throwing away a fertilized egg.
That is what they're doing, yes.
In the trash.
Well, I don't know. Again, I don't know what the process is. I wouldn't say trash. It is discarded. Let's use that term.
Okay, when you say it is discarded, like, what's the it? You know, like, I mean, that's the, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, Bill. I'm just saying this is a point, is like, when does life begin? And is that a life? Is that a human being? That's the point. You know, everybody says, you know, follow the science. But if you're really truly following the science, then, you know, once a sperm, the instant that sperm meets the egg, that's a human being.
Yeah, I'll leave it up to others. I mean, because I'm not an expert. I don't know. I will admit when there's something, a topic that I don't know how to address, I don't know enough to address it. I will admit that this happens to be one of those cases. Do I have a position on it myself? I will admit again, I do not, because I don't have all the facts. It's right up there with abortion.
That's the whole point, is that this is, I mean, ultimately voters are being asked to basically decide this right now. And I don't think all the voters truly understand exactly it's always framed in women's rights and bodily autonomy and everything like that. But at the end of the day, it's killing a baby. Yeah. I mean, that's really what it is at the end of the day.
Well, I'll leave it at that because, again, Andrew, I can't answer the question. I'm not an expert on the procedure, so I don't know how to address that particular angle.
And I respect that. But I just think that, you don't see this on the television commercials. It's always framed in constitutional matters and whatnot. But at the end of the day, when you're, quote unquote, throwing away an embryo, I mean, what are you truly doing?
Yeah, there are a lot of sticky issues here. I'm not going to get into them. But there are a lot of angles to this story that could really make for a very sticky situation. And again, isn't it science putting society in a very tough position here to try and make decisions based on things that science itself created? Isn't that exactly what's going on here?
Yeah, it seems like they always say follow the science when it's politically convenient for them. But then when it's all of a sudden the science interferes with their political agenda, then all of a sudden it's just like they conveniently leave out some science, but not all science,
What I find interesting, if I can stick with the abortion story for a moment, I find it interesting that when I don't mean to be gross here, but when a pregnant woman is shot and killed, and the baby that she's carrying is killed as well, it's two murders considered by the law. Yet when a woman is carrying a child and it's aborted, that child is not a human life at that point. So how can we have it? How can our laws have it both ways? How in one instance can that child be a human being? And in another instance, it's not a living human being. Someone needs to explain that to me.
Yeah, it's based on the political party of who's doing who you're asking,
But well, not necessarily, because there are some Republicans who also believe that. Your more moderate Republicans believe that. So it's not just Democrats, if that's where you're heading, that hold that view.
Yeah, it seems like people are picking and choosing which science. It's either a life or it's not a life. And unfortunately, voters, it's the political system that's basically deciding this.
And at some point, well, maybe I'm dreaming here, but at some point we need to get the politics out of these issues, and leave it up to individuals to decide. I don't believe that the government should be, and I know there are people out there listening who are going to be very angry with me for what I'm about ready to say, but there are some issues that the government clearly should not be telling us one way or the other. What is the answer? The answer should lie with the individual, not the government. But that's my final say. And I'll leave the final word up to you, Andrew.
We'll leave it at that.
All right, Andrew, thanks for the call today. I appreciate it.
Yep, no problem.
All right, bye-bye now. Want to talk a little bit. You might have heard me mention this to Congressman Muser yesterday regarding the impeachment articles against Mayorkas, the secretary, and Alejandro Mayorkas, the secretary of the Homeland Security. Well, according to Fox News, Republican senators have convinced House Speaker Mike Johnson to delay the delivery of two impeachment articles against Alejandro Mayorkas, citing concerns that Senate Democrats will look to quickly dismiss them once a trial begins in the upper chamber. To ensure the Senate has adequate time to perform its constitutional duty, the House will transmit the articles of impeachment to the Senate next week, not this week. There's no reason whatsoever for the Senate to abdicate its responsibility to hold an impeachment trial, Those are the words of a spokesperson for Speaker Johnson. At least 10 Republican senators say they were actively pressuring the speaker to delay delivering the articles in order to prevent Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and the Democrat caucus from tabling the trial ahead of the weekend and sending senators home shortly after, a source familiar with the situation says. The benefit of a delay for the Republicans, according to the source, is allowing the articles of impeachment against Mayorkas more time for debate without the pressure of the approaching weekend. Well, then there is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's side of this. I'm getting this from the Washington Times. He said yesterday that Democrats will move to derail an impeachment trial for Alejandro Mayorkas, saying the charges against him are bogus. Schumer did not say exactly what method Democrats will use, but other senators say it could involve either tabling or moving to dismiss the case, which could be done through a majority vote. Republicans decried the expected move that would be the first time in history the Senate shirked its duty to conduct a trial after the House impeached an official. So, of course, we'll stay on top of this, as I'm sure ABC News will as well, and we'll see where that heads in the next week or so. With that said, we'll take a break. We'll be back with the final moments of hour number two of this edition of Feedback in just a bit. Stay with us.
A new generation of talk. News Talk 830 WEEU.
And now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
All right, that does it for hour number two of today's edition of Feedback. Coming up in hour number three, I'll be joined by Reading City Council President Donna Reed, and she'll be taking your questions at 610-374-8800. Or toll-free, 888-401-0459. In the meantime, we're going to break for news. Get the latest in state stories from Radio PA and national and international stories from ABC News, followed by sports, weather own Bob McCool, and another check on weather. It's all here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU, and I thank you for being on your end of the radio or the Internet, whatever the case might be. Stay right where you are. We'll be back in just a bit.
And now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU. The voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back to Feedback, the third and final hour of this Wednesday edition of the show, your on-air town square. Our phone numbers here are 610-374-8800 or toll-free, 888-401-0459. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders along with Sean Tansky, and I'm very honored to have as my guest in the studio today, Reading City Council President Donna Reed. Donna, good morning. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
I always love it. I always love it when you're here in the studio with us today. And let me get started first and foremost with you. You folks held a public meeting last night at Albright College's McMillan campus, and there were two issues that you had to address: parking on Hampton Boulevard and the visibility and safety issues at the intersection of North 13th and Pike Streets. How did that meeting go?
Well, I missed the early part of the meeting because I was at the R-Phil's opener. As we,
Oh, no, you did get to the game.
I also serve on the stadium commission as this council liaison, so it's like divided loyalties. I've never figured out how our late state senator, Mike Opaque, was able to be at four places at once. But he's, he had the magic touch that I don't seem to have, but I did get there a little late. I want to give some kudos out to Councilman Wesley Butler, who represents that area. Yesterday happened to be his birthday, so what a way to spend a birthday at a community meeting. Wes did a fabulous job. He's a valuable, wonderful part of our city council. And this has been an ongoing issue. Primarily, one of the major issues is the speeding on Hampden Boulevard, if you're familiar with Hampden Boulevard. A road built a century ago, wide road. Why they never put grassy medians in there when it was built, as we see on Reading Boulevard, Wyomissing Boulevard, Hancock Boulevard. We see that throughout the city and suburbs. That road is just a huge, wide road. And, of course, people pick up speed. It's called an arterial road. That's actually the name of it. And, you know, the question is pulling out from the side streets, the visibility, where there should be parking, where there shouldn't be parking, what can we do to make it easier, safer for people pulling out from those side streets? What can we do to calm the traffic on Hampden Boulevard? Is it worth looking at a grassy median being installed there?
Okay.
And there's grants out there. There's possibilities through DCNR and PennDOT and other places that should that be one of the decisions made to calm the traffic and also beautify the street. There's grant possibilities out there.
Okay.
Doesn't mean we'll get them, but they're there to explore. And there's also other things, you know, bringing the curb out a little bit, redirecting how the painting of the street is done. If you're familiar with Ken Horse Boulevard, that was done a couple years ago, a bike lane, repainting so that the two lanes of traffic have more visibly a constricted width in which to drive, which has really helped the situation on Hancock, on Ken Horse Boulevard. The issue here is we've had traffic studies done through McCormick Taylor to determine volume, which determines signage, stop signs, flashing lights, traffic lights, and the amount of traffic volume does not meet criteria established by PennDOT, which is therefore then a universal criteria that the Federal Highway Administration, all this is really, it's understandable, I get it, as someone who served in government for a long time, but that's no consolation to the neighbors and the community that have seen last summer two particularly gruesome motorcycle accidents, one in which a decapitation occurred. Imagine outside your house. That's happening.
Wow.
The, you know, on a lesser note, I mean, there's been many injuries. That's very, the human condition's the most important thing. But on another note, there have been people who have lost two, three cars because people spin out of control.
That were parked along the side.
Wow. And many folks talked about that. A local business that needs the parking alongside, you know, their business, because it is, it's an R2 area, so there are some small businesses with residences, primarily R1, but there are some R2 things. If the parking is constricted, what happens to her business? You know, it's a long-established business, a second generation, actually.
Right. Oh, wow.
So there's so many issues involved and so much understandable emotion involved in it. You know, people that cars crash into their front yards and, you know, can I play there safely with my one-year-old grandson wondering if a car is going to crash?
Wow.
You know, those are the kind of things that are quality of life matters. And, yeah, there's the federal highway criteria. How does that translate? State tends to supersede local control. But what can we do locally to do it? And do we just say, you know what, we're fed up. We're going to, council's going to take on this. We're going to create ordinances for the stop signs and let the chips fall where they may. But then again, there's legal ramifications.
Sure.
If we do that and stop signs go up and it doesn't follow criteria, guess who gets sued?
It's
very frustrating. I feel frustrated. I feel frustrated for the folks. I've encouraged last night, you know, get more petitions. There's already been petitions. And let's see what we can do. If we have to you know, hopefully working with our state reps, Representative Rossi represents that area, mm-hmm. Senator Schwenk. If we have to go to the governor's office, then let's get a contingent of people and go to the governor's office and say, we need something. But
I'm going to have Judy Schwenk on the show Friday, actually. So we'll bring this topic up with her.
I'm sure she will address it. Yeah. Judy has been, so as Mark and Jahani and Manny have been as state reps, so helpful to us in the city. So I'm always encouraged something can happen, but totally understand the frustrations.
Timeline. What's the next step now? Now that you've heard the concerns about Hampton Boulevard, what's the next step?
Well, what can we do interim? Can we paint the crosswalks so that they're more noticeable? We could do some parking ordinances for line of sight. That doesn't necessarily help the racing, the speeding on Hampton Boulevard. Mm-hmm. It may help with the pulling out from like 13th and Pike, 13th and Amity, all these different streets. But that doesn't solve the issue of the racing on Hampton Boulevard. Mm-hmm. And what can we do within our purview? Can we put grading on the pavement so that you feel that when you're driving, that it automatically slows you if you feel an impediment as you're driving? Speed bumps are probably unlikely.
Yeah, right.
Because given that. Mm-hmm. of snowplows and the danger, they can keep people from going slow, but they can also create additional issues for those who think they're better than a speed bump.
Right, yeah.
So there's, nothing's ever simple, but I understand the frustration, and I live off Schuylkill Avenue. I see what happens and how fast the traffic goes there, even near the elementary school, and it mm-hmm. makes me crazy. And I know Councillor Nunez, who represents our area, feels much the same.
We got a couple of people on the phone who want to talk with you.
Absolutely.
So let's go to Mary in Reading, who has a question for you. Mary, thank you for calling in. What's your question for President Reed?
Hi. Thanks for having me on today. So I live in the city, and I've just been listening to some of the meetings and wondering, you know, we have a large population of non-English speakers and high Spanish speakers and you know, monolingual, in addition to other languages being spoken, and wondering what can be done for language access for, you know, public city meetings, particularly for council, so people can be aware and up to date of what's happening and, you know, able to participate easily.
Sure, and we've certainly discussed this. As you know, a majority of our elected officials at this point are of Latino mm-hmm. descent or background. The charter, while people can Google translate the charter, that will be done officially. There's a cost involved. We are looking at ways in which there can be, I mean, frankly, there should be both translation available that people can read as we're speaking. We have to look into the technology of that and how that can work. I know several of our counselors will translate something going as they go forward, as we talk about things.
Mm-hmm.
That's great for the majority of folks in the city, but for those of us who don't speak Spanish, it's hard to understand what's going on. It's a complicated issue because you want everyone to be understanding everything. So the technology that we installed, which was back in 2020 when everybody was trying to grab whatever technology they could so that we mm-hmm. could do Zoom, we're looking at upgrading that. And I think when that's upgraded, we'll be able to at least do closed captions, hopefully at least in Spanish. I mean, and it doesn't solve everything because there's other languages that are spoken in the city. You know, there's folks from West Africa that speak different languages there. We have a Romanian population. We have a Vietnamese population. We have 60 different nationalities represented in our city based on Census 2020.
Now she raises a good point because if my memory serves me right, even the agenda and the meeting minutes that appear online are just in English. Am I right
correct,
there?
Correct. You can use like a Google translation or something, and I believe there's a navigation tool on the city website. I'd have to double check, but I believe they can become available.
Okay.
But I have to double check, so I apologize. Not
gotcha.
Being certain.
Okay. Mary, thank you for your call. I appreciate the question today. Let's go to Ernie in Reading, who's got a question for you. Ernie, good morning. Welcome to Feedback.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Council President.
Hi, Ernie.
I just want to comment on the Hampton Boulevard thing, and I think that when and until the state allows municipalities to use radar detection,
yeah.
Are we going to change any of the speeding issues? Because not only on Hamden Boulevard do people speed, they speed in every municipality in the state, but yet only the state police are allowed to use radar detection.
It's a huge frustration.
And every time it comes up in the legislature, it just becomes a political football issue because the state's district attorneys and the state police unions block it.
Absolutely.
And
I mean, you live near
at the same time, we need these valuable tools down on the local level. You know, one of the issues is that they always say, well, the municipality will use it as a revenue generator.
Yeah.
Well, they only get so much of the ticket anyway.
Right. Correct.
Ernie, I think we lost you there. Donna, did you want to address?
Yeah, and Ernie's right. I mean, that's it's a huge frustration. And Ernie, I was going to say, lives near Center Avenue. Mm-hmm. That has become a speedway. Mm-hmm. At Center Avenue, I think we had a car overturned at Center in Windsor a few days ago. How do you get your car overturned without going incredibly fast?
Right.
And I know friends who have had cars totaled along that area. Center Avenue should not be a speedway. Fifth Street should not be a speedway. Lancaster Avenue, Schuylkill Avenue. We have many of those where it would be, we can do timed enforcement. We actually have just gotten a grant that enables our police officers to do some of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different than radar, and they would have to explain the differential. But we're hoping that maybe that will set a tone if people realize their consequences. But we're seeing aggressive driving around here to an extent we've never seen it. And it becomes so apparent to me when I drive, even meeting friends in Bucks County or Montgomery or something, there is a differential. There is not the kind of aggressive driving we're seeing here in Redding and Berks County. And I don't know what is causing it. But it is clearly out of hand, people going through red lights. I don't know about you, but I'm always really careful. I don't want to get T-boned when I come out of an intersection.
Right.
And it shouldn't be like that.
In fact, I noticed that at the intersection right out here at 4th and Court. I never, when we get the green light on Court Street, I never make that right onto 4th Street until I have made sure that the traffic coming down 4th Street has come to a complete stop.
Absolutely. And that's we should all do. I mean, it's unfortunate, but, you know, someone who travels Schuylkill Avenue every day because of where I live, right behind a Glenside school, I'm always cognizant of that because mm-hmm. the numbers of people who just, I don't know why they think they have free reign. It really worries me with the little kids, you
right.
know,
absolutely.
At Glenside and at the magnet school as well. It's, you know, the unnice part of me would love to get out of the car and slam on their hood and tell them what I think, which is not something I could say here in the air, but you know, you're not going to get out of your car and create another scenario.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
I did enjoy the other day somebody speeding past me, and then I got to the red light at West Windsor and Schuylkill, the
uh-huh,
Four Point
right,
intersection.
Right, yeah.
They were sitting there waiting to turn left, and I just cruised through it 25, 50, you know, 35 miles per hour, and I waved to them. Like, I wanted to do other things with my fingers, but I did not. So this guy who thought he was a big deal, there he was sitting, and I was going straight through at Schuylkill.
One thing I remember when Richard Torinelli was police chief, mm-hmm. and one of the last times that he was on this show while he was still police chief, he indicated to me that he was given the directive to study various dangerous intersections in the city. Did anything ever come of that study?
We do have a list of them. I can't give it to you off the top of my mm-hmm. head.
I understand.
But I know that that's something that, you know, certainly is looked at by our police department. Our new chief, who I would encourage you to have come on.
He has been on the show already.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My mistake. I should have realized
that's
I apologize.
Okay.
I've been very encouraged with him and his philosophy of, you know, really digging into where the high crime and high traffic issues are, and I think you'll be seeing results from that. Again, it takes a little time to reorganize, but again, we have this new grant for the timing and all that kind of thing. So I'm very encouraged with Chief Vasquez and going forward.
Okay. There was an ordinance introduced Monday night of this week to place a referendum on this year's general election ballot. The question reads the following: shall the Reading Home Rule Charter be amended to provide City Council with the ability to terminate department directors by supermajority vote? What prompted this ordinance, and What are its chances of passing?
Well, I actually brought something like this up in 2022.
Okay.
When I was District 5 representative. And my concern is that we play a role in approving department head placement positions.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, there is we have no say.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I think you said that the last time you were on the show.
I may have.
Yeah.
And two of the counselors brought this back up to me and said, can we put it on the agenda? And I said, certainly. You know, I certainly see the value of it. I still see the value of it. I know the mayor is not particularly happy about it, and I understand where he's coming from under this form of government. However, and it's not directed at any one person or any one administration. For someone like me who's been involved or served in every administration, from the Oppenheimer, McMahon, Spencer, Scott, and now Moran administrations, we've seen the good, the bad, and the indifferent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it is not directed at any one person. It's you know, certainly complaints come to us as counselors, and we refer to the charter and the fact that this is where our power stops. To me, it seems logical. If you have a say in hiring, you should probably have a say in termination. Again, that it should not be political, that it should be for cause. Because under this charter now that we have, if I'm the mayor and you're a department director and I don't like the color of your shirt, I can say thank you, but you're done because mm-hmm. I don't like the color of your shirt.
Mm-hmm.
It can be that willy-nilly. Is it that way? No, it's not. But that's not a great thing.
Okay.
And when you look at council and you look at the council staff and the changing faces of council over the years, we have our chief clerk who has been there since 1996 with all the changes in councilors over the years. Our deputy clerk, a decade plus. Our legislative aide, 5 years plus. The continuity and the importance of that for stability is, I think, an example of why there should be more than one person making a decision.
With that said, I want to talk to you about the vote where by a 5-2 vote, a bill was rejected that would have amended the city council to allow an elected city council member to sit on the Reading Parking Authority Board. And I believe you and Councilman Chris Miller were the only two who voted yes for that bill.
We voted
you voted no.
No.
I beg your pardon.
Yeah, it was, I believe, Councilor Ventura and Councilor Baez who voted yes for
okay.
it.
Okay. All right. So I misunderstood the minutes then to the meeting.
Basically, the issue with that, and I understand why Councilor Ventura brought that to the agenda, and I'm glad she did, because we all have concerns about the parking authority. I
mm-hmm.
think if you work in the city, I think if you visit the city, if you are in the city, as we all are, there are concerns and viable concerns. And I certainly understand her point of view of bringing this forward. But I'm the only person who, sitting on council now, also sat in the parking authority for a few years when I was off council and I had gone back into the news and then back into private business.
Okay.
And it's very clear to me that you can't do both
mm-hmm.
because conflicts of interest, as a board member, you would be privy on the parking authority side to executive sessions as you would be with council to
mm-hmm.
executive sessions. Sometimes businesses issues overlap. Where's your loyalty going to be? I truly believe everybody would do the right thing, but it is a divided loyalty, and it's a murky area. And it just, from my perspective and my experience, would never have made sense to serve on both in an approved voting capacity.
Okay.
So I do understand, and I appreciate her interest, and I think that was important, but I just don't see how it would work. Obviously, there were five of us who had the same concerns. It doesn't preclude us at some point in time doing an investigation. If something's really, really off and we're worried, we as council have the ability to do an investigation.
Okay. We've got another caller, another listener who has mm-hmm. a question for you. Pablo is on the line. Pablo, good morning. What's your question for Council President Donna Reed?
Hi, Council Donna Reed. I'm a New Yorker transplant here in Pennsylvania in the summer '83. I think I'm more now a Pennsylvanian than a New Yorker.
Well, welcome. We're glad you're here.
Yes. I don't live too far away from EEU. I bought my house a couple blocks away from it when I was 16 years old. I was in 1985. I'm the oldest one living in my neighborhood.
Wow.
But my neighborhood went from good to bad to great again. But what I've been seeing now more in the city, God bless me with a 9-year-old, sometimes we're driving, and we see these four-wheelers and motorcycles flying with no plates, no nothing. They just eating lights, going between cars. And just yesterday, I was coming from City Park with my son, and the same thing, passing right past the police station with no hands or butts. Can anything be done about that?
Well, you're certainly not alone in your concerns, and I agree with you. My son and his family live right off Lancaster Avenue, and what we can see from their house is astonishing. And I live off Schuylkill Avenue. The disregard these folks have for pedestrians, for motorists, is astonishing. I believe there was some kind of converging of folks up in City Park over the weekend with, you know, loudspeakers, with the dirt bikes, with, you know, the whole circular area there almost precluding traffic from going through. But I know our police are aware of it. We have a policy that if we can get these dirt bikes and they're not legal, if they're not, ownership is not proved, we do have a board that rules on it, seizes them, and they are destroyed. The question is, and I understand where the police are coming from, and I certainly understand the frustration because we all see it, you especially see it downtown. The police don't want to engage in a chase that could create a worse situation.
True. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they're trying in their best way to find out, and this is where you as an anonymous source could be helpful, is there a place in your neighborhood where they're being stored, that people are converging and coming out in a afternoon or evening? And if you can provide, and you could do it anonymously to Crime Alert or to the police department, a source of where these are being stored and being utilized, our police can then do some investigations. So I would encourage you to do that. Again, if you go via Crime Alert or through the police department, your identity would not be shared.
Pablo, thank you for the call and for the question. Appreciate that today. And in the few moments remaining, you've got a couple of things coming up today.
We do. We have this afternoon on Miltimore Street, two more Habitat houses that are being dedicated. The owners will be taking ownership of them today, and Habitat has done amazing work down at the Buttonwood Gateway area.
Right.
I encourage everyone to go down and see these beautiful new homes and the proud homeowners. And, you know, as Pablo said, talking about bringing a neighborhood back, what is being done down there is fabulous. And it's an important part of the city. It's a gateway to the city, to West Reading.
Right.
All the businesses that people can either bike to, walk to from there, the beauty of the area right near the river, it's kudos to Habitat and to those folks who, with their sweat equity and their learning finances and home ownership needs, the volunteers that help build the houses, it's always a very happy day when we're able to be there. We have the upcoming inauguration of Glynis Fitzgerald, Alvernia president, on Friday, so we're very excited about that.
She'll be the eighth president of Alvernia, if I remember correctly.
And all the good that Alvernia has done for our community.
Mm-hmm,
so
right.
We're excited about that. We have visiting students from Reutlingen, our sister city in Germany,
who are
at Reading High School right now. So we'll be, the mayor and the administration and myself will be hosting a little pizza party for them on Friday morning, and we're happy they're here. There's just so much going on.
You had a visitor at last night.
On Monday
or
night.
Monday night.
Yes, we had a mayor from Zambia in Africa, and she was, and I apologize, I don't have her name in front of me, and nor do I have the district that she represents, but she's the first female mayor of that particular district in Zambia, and she was gracious, sweet. The mayor couldn't be there at the meeting, so she sat in the mayor's chair.
Oh, my.
Our managing director made a little nameplate for her. So there
cool.
She, and she was just incredibly gracious and kind and decent, and I hated to see her leave, even though I knew her for an hour. I hated to. I know she's like probably just about on her way back to Zambia now.
And you told me off air why she was here in the area.
Yeah, she was through International Women's Month, which was March. She was doing some tours of parts of the United States, and Reading somehow got on her radar screen, and we're very grateful.
Oh, that's cool.
And she invited us all over there, and I'm very tempted. Let me tell you, I've never been to Africa. It's always been mysterious and entrancing to me, but you know.
Oh my.
And just one other thing I quick want to mention is Axel Noble, which is based in mm-hmm. Greater Lower Glenside, as I like to call it. They had a rededication of their facility. They put about $30 million into it. They're hiring. Oh. It's a fabulous facility. It's part of an international conglomerate that does $10 billion globally.
Whoa.
$3 billion in the U.S. And out of our plant, $300 million.
Nice.
With 5,000 customers, and they create powder coatings in 3,000 different colors, applications all over the way, and a little history note here.
Huh?
Powder coatings, the genesis, the beginning of those, Greater Lower Glenside off Columbia Avenue, the precursor to when it was Roman Hawes and all the others.
Oh, my.
So that's another little star in Reading's.
Oh, that's cool.
Reading's firmament.
I like that. Donna, thank you.
Thank you. It's always fun to be here, and I appreciate your interest and the viewer and the listener's interest in the city of Reading. And please know that you can call the council office. You know, we'll do our best to get back to you, and we're well aware of some of the frustrations that have been voiced here, and we've got some good folks there who will do their best to help out.
Reading City Council President Donna Reed this morning. Donna, thank you again. Appreciate
thank you.
That. You enjoy the rest of your day, okay?
Good morning to everybody. Thank you.
We'll be back with more of Feedback on this Wednesday morning in just a bit. Stay with us.
Serving Barnesville, Schuylkill Haven, Tremont, and all of Schuylkill County. This is News Talk 830, WEEU.
And now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back to Feedback here on Air Town Square on the voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Our phone number is here at 610-374-8800 or toll free, 888-401-0459. Let's go back to the phones right now. Gerson in Reading wants to talk about the interview with Donna Reed. Gerson, good morning. Welcome to Feedback today.
Good morning, Mr. Sanders, and to everyone, and Sean, and, well, I appreciate the opportunity here. I'm grateful to be alive, and another day on this earth, and I'm very grateful for that always. I wanted to, I was very excited about the baseball game yesterday when I called the show mornings with Mike this morning. I obviously shared that. Good to see a large presence of the community present. Really, really beautiful time and a great game. Got to see former co-host and host for a little bit of time of the morning show, Noel. So he was seemed to be doing very well. I obviously got to see WEU's owner, Mr. John, as well. So a lot of good people present. Now, reason of my call, and to be brief, basically I couldn't call during the time that President and Councilwoman Reed was present. But I did wanted to ask you if you saw it appropriate or if the opportunity permitted and you chose to do so on the next opportunity that she may come or if you have the opportunity with the chief of police or whoever it may be, people making decisions as such, to ask what could be further done to enforce any current laws, preferably not have to make new ones, but if necessary, to amend either local ordinances or make, you know, new laws, write new laws and pass them as appropriate to enforce this misbehavior, obviously, when it comes to any type of vehicles, whether dirt bikes or any vehicles not properly licensed or with plates or with expiration tags, these vehicles with tinted windows, inappropriate or illegally hinted, you know, whether they're from with Pennsylvania Place or other states outside the states, which there's plenty of those that I see around. And more importantly, for people that behave in these reckless behaviors that cause damages to property, whether it's to city property or more, or just as importantly, to residence property, people, obviously, free citizens that have damages, whether to the vehicles, their homes, or just as important or even more important to life, causing injuries or causing death. How is it that, you know, appropriate, obviously, under the law, we shouldn't have unusual and cruel punishments or fines and such, but I also, under the Constitution, but somehow we have to deter people from engaging in these acts. Obviously, taking away through fines some of their finances is one way to achieve that, as sad as that may be or sound, but also their freedom. I mean, one thing is causing damage, which is not acceptable, but even just as much or even more not acceptable is causing someone injury or death. You know, we have family, some of us kids, grandkids, I mean, anyone in general, our neighbors. I mean, people are just going about their life trying to live. Why should they be living in fear, getting in the car, walking down the road to the next block, to the store, going to work? I mean, obviously, if somebody causes injury or death, they certainly shouldn't be, I mean, if they're making that choice to engage in such type of behavior, most likely knowingly that, hey, you lose control of that vehicle, you're in a school zone, you run that stop sign or that school bus, there's a kid crossing, an adult, a pedestrian, a car. Just like Ms. Donna Reed said, she doesn't want to be T-boned, neither do I. I don't want to engage in any accident. I don't want to cause anybody any hurt either. I think I shared that with you before. And
right,
there are people just not observing the stop signs, the red lights, and I tried the 3-second rule. I have passed that to my children or any, you know, my son-in-law, anyone that I have taught the rules of the road before getting the licenses, in their ways to their permits, getting the licenses. Anyways, that's the reason of my call. I just was wondering what could be done to further enforce current laws, preferably, or any new ones as necessary to really put some sense, hopefully, in the heart and minds of people that, listen, you engage in this, this is not going to be tolerated, or there will be these consequences and hold them accountable to it. Thank you, sir, and I appreciate the show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. That's my rant.
Gerson, thank you. I appreciated the call and your opinions that you shared with us today. Thank you, buddy.
Thank you, everyone.
All right, bye-bye now. I remember when I first took over hosting Feedback, and that was back in June of 2021, that we talked about illegal dirt bikes driving on the streets of the city. And I thought something had been done back then. And sure enough, I just Googled this, and an article from WFMZ came up dated May 18th of 2021. And here's what they wrote at the time. Over the last month, Reading police have been cracking down on the use of illegal dirt bikes. And the article quotes Deputy Chief Javier Ruiz in this piece from WFMZ, where he said at the time, they target certain areas where we get the most complaints about motorcycles, and they go out there and look for the illegal motorcycles and ATVs that are committing infractions. And the article goes on to say, on Monday, Public Works, and this was back in May of 2021 now, on Monday, Public Works loaded up bikes that were confiscated by local police, many of them not street legal. Deputy Chief Ruiz said many of these bikes are lacking proper paperwork and are missing safety features, such as lights and signals. He said, paired with how fast they tear through the city, run through stop signs and through traffic lights, they can be very dangerous. This is part of the reason why officers are getting as many of them as they can off the streets. It goes on, but I thought there was something underway that the police department was doing about illegal dirt bikes. But again, I see that given what we're hearing here, that it continues to be a problem in the city. And the next time we have the new police chief on, the next quarter that we have him on, we'll address this issue with him. So, Gerson, thank you. I appreciated the call today. Let's see. I've got just a few moments left here. Something else that I talked with Congressman Muser about yesterday was Marjorie Taylor Greene, who to me is to the Republican Party as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is to the Democrats. For those of you who don't know who Marjorie Taylor Greene, she is a congresswoman from Georgia. Well, according to the Washington Times, Ms. Greene blasted House Speaker Mike Johnson in a letter to fellow Republicans yesterday, accusing the Speaker of complete and total surrender to Democrats throughout his time with the gavel. So here we go again, another effort underway to oust a House Speaker in just a few months' time from when Kevin McCarthy was ousted as Speaker. She explained in her letter why she opted to file a motion to vacate the chair, arguing that Mr. Johnson has failed to make good on the promises he made when he won the Speaker race in October. The firebrand Republican contended that Mr. Johnson has gone against each of his seven conservative tenets that he listed to the GOP after winning the gavel. This has been a complete and total surrender to, if not complete and total lockstep with, the Democrats' agenda that has angered our Republican base so much and given them very little reason to vote for a Republican House majority, Ms. Greene wrote. Well, with the confusion and the chaos that has ensued over the last couple of months in the House, why would the voters want to vote in a Republican House majority again, I have to ask? Well, she goes on to write, as a matter of fact, if we win the House this fall, it will only be because President Trump is on the ballot, not because we've earned it. Her attempt to oust Johnson has received little traction among her colleagues. In fact, Congressman Muser sidestepped that issue yesterday when we talked, who still remember the disarray from when former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy was booted by 8 Republicans and all Democrats last year. Some Republicans fear that if an ouster this time is successful, it would hand Democrats the majority in the House on a silver platter. So I do not understand, I don't understand what Marjorie Taylor Greene is all about. And the reason why I compare her to AOC is that both women, and it's not because they're women, please don't misunderstand me, but both seem to go out of their way to grab headlines, to grab the attention of the media. And it just drives me crazy. They're not productive except for getting media attention. And somewhere along the lines, it's got to stop. We have to be consistent here and act like a cohesive party, which the Republicans are not doing. Anyway, we'll take a break. We'll be back with the final seconds of today's feedback show in just a bit. Stay with us.
Oh, what a dream. Oh, what a story. Don't have to weep. Come and enjoy your smile. Opening scene. It's just like a doorway. Here's a story.
Talk and weather.
It's the topics that matter to me.
A new generation of talk. News Talk 830 WEEU.
The voice of Berks and Beyond.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. And for those of you who shared your opinions with us, you folks are the stars of the show. We'll do it again tomorrow. I want to thank my producer, Sean Tansky. Thank you, buddy.
No problem, Bill.
And we will be back tomorrow. Same time, same station. I always wanted to say that. In the meantime, we're going to break for news with Radio PA and ABC, and Bob McCool will have a check on sports, and then it's a whole afternoon of talk radio for you, starting with the Dan Bongino Show from noon to 3, and then it'll be the Ramsey Show from 3 to 6 here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. And until tomorrow, make it a great rest of your day today. That'll do it for this episode of Feedback. To comment on the show, you can email us at feedback@830weeu.com. You can also hear our show live from 9 a.m. to noon Eastern Time at 830weeu.com or on the TuneIn app. For producer Sean Tansky, I'm Bill Saunders. Thanks for listening.